Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll deal with a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak with Mia Bloom, who is an assistant professor of political science at the University of Cincinnati and a consultant to the New Jersey Office of Counterterrorism. She's the author of a new book, Dying to Kill, The Allure of Suicide Terror. We'll be talking to her about what makes the people who set off these bombs, particularly the more recent ones in London, what makes them tick. And she spent a lot of time interviewing suicide bombers, obviously those whose explosives didn't go off. And we'll look at the whole international phenomenon of suicide terrorism. We'll also talk with Bruce Shapira, who's an investigative reporter and political analyst who has written extensively on civil rights, human rights, and the death penalty, and the Supreme Court for Salon.com, the New York Times, Harper's, the Guardian of London, and The Nation magazine. He teaches investigative journalism at Yale University, and his most recent book is Shaking the Foundations, 200 Years of Investigative Journalism in America. We'll be talking to him, obviously, about the big story that's continuing here in spite of having the Supreme Court nominees take it off the headlines for a while, the Karl Rove, Scooter Libby vulnerability to the special prosecutor continues to worm its way through both the law and the press. We'll be talking to Bruce Shapira both about the new nominee for the Supreme Court and his take on where the case is heading, the Karl Rove, or the special prosecutor's case, in the outing of the wife of the American diplomat, Joe Wilson. We'll also talk with a CIA case officer who was a classmate of Valerie Wilson, Valerie Plame, the woman whose career was destroyed by the White House and led to the CIA referred, made a criminal referral to the Justice Department. And it has obviously taken an awful long time to find out who is guilty, and it continues to take time, which in itself it begs the question of who's holding this thing up. We'll be talking with, as I say, a classmate of Valerie Plame's from the farm, the CIA training ground, Jim Marcinkowski. He also testified this week in the House of Representatives, a Democratic forum, relegated to a back room, but was played on C-SPAN, where a number of colleagues of Valerie Plame's and others, CIA officers and intelligence officers, talked about the importance of her cover and tried to refute the Republican talking points that have been effective in trying to minimize the case against potential case against Karl Rove and Scooter Libby by suggesting it's all just politics as usual. Let's begin with Mia Bloom, who is the author of Dying to Kill, The Allure of Suicide Terror. And Mia, spoke a week ago with an Italian expert on terrorism, and we were talking about the vis-a-vis the first London bombings, the lethal bombings, as opposed to more recent ones where the explosive TATP didn't ignite, but the ability of Al-Qaeda to continually jerk our chain. I mean, how is it that the world's only superpower has been goaded into an endless war by a hopeless fanatic?
Well, it's a complicated series of questions. I'm not sure where to begin. I mean, it seems that Al-Qaeda is very adept at manipulating, for instance, religious ideology or Quranic hadiths and verses to try to justify what they ultimately have as political goals. One of their political goals is to bring down the Crusader infidels that they perceive having invaded not just Iraq but Saudi Arabia, but also the negative impact of the West on Islam, that Islam is defeated and being made to feel humiliated as a general rule. But with regard to its ability to then take, let's say, British-born South Asians and turn them into human bombs, I would say that that's something that's truly unique and that it's worrisome because, as we know, Europeans are able to get into the United States without being questioned. They don't have to go through the same processes as people coming directly from the police. So if in essence there are European sleeper cells, it adds an additional layer of concern to counterterrorism in the United States.
But to the question that Loretta Napoleoni, the Italian terror expert, we discussed a week or so ago, is again, why do we take their bait? This is essentially asymmetrical warfare, is it not, where the weak strike back against the strong. I mean, we are the lone superpower. We have an endless arsenal of nuclear weapons, none of which, of course, do us any good in the war on terror. And they are able to attack us with box cutters and low-tech bombs and use this very efficient means of delivering these bombs. But again, it seems that it's hardly a coincidence that the bombings, the first bombing in London, happened on the eve of the opening of the G8 conference, where all of the powerful leaders of the world were gathered. Wasn't al-Qaeda and bin Laden essentially gate-crashing the party and reminding us, or at least trying to put themselves as major state actors?
No, absolutely. And it's very clear to me that al-Qaeda's intention is both to disrupt the G8 conference as well as have an impact on British public opinion with regard to support for the war. But I would say that in terms of what Ms. Napoleoni, who's a fantastic expert on the way in which terrorists are funded, I don't know why the United States allows itself to be goaded. I think that the current administration has its own perception of world politics and ideology is part and parcel of their foreign policy choices. So if the question is asking me whether or not the Iraq war is a good idea, I would come down with a lot of the other counterterrorism experts and say no. I think that the war complicates our war on terror as well as our safety. But it's a good point. I think it's interesting that we shouldn't forget that a little over a year ago, there were two South Asian Muslims, also from the United Kingdom, who perpetrated a suicide bombing at Mike's Place in Israel. And I think that this was the first signal that that there were elements of the South Asian population in the United Kingdom that were being recruited by al-Qaeda or recruited by suicide terrorist organizations in general.
Well, the Israelis have just released information indicating that one of the suicide bombers, Mohammed Khan, he did a reconnaissance in Israel for those two that you just mentioned.
So it's clear that there was a connection, but there was also a connection that we're not talking about with Lashkar-e-Taiba and Kashmir. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, while there is a great deal of discussion about the war in Iraq, the war in Afghanistan, the ongoing Arab-Israeli or Arab-Palestinian-Israeli conflict, we're not really talking about Kashmir. And I think that in terms of inspiring the South Asian Muslims of the United Kingdom, Kashmir is one of the primary issues that get them going to jihad. And I think it's in Kashmir where they're potentially getting the training, not necessarily in the madrasas of Pakistan. But I think that it's too early to know for sure.
Well, of course, the South Asian phenomenon of suicide bombing, which I believe is essentially where it sort of came under the radar first, was in Sri Lanka with the Tamil Tigers. And I believe, according to your book, Dying to Kill, The Allure of Suicide Terror, Mia Bloom, there, 40% of those suicide, and they, of course, are not Islamic, they're Hindu, were women?
Yeah, absolutely. About 40%, if we count in the more recent suicide bombings in Kilpitsia in July of 2004. But basically, from 2001 until 2004, the LTTE voluntarily stopped engaging in suicide bombing. What's interesting, again, when we look at the interconnectedness of the groups, the LTTE received this training and information in Lebanon from Palestinians and from Palestinian organizations. And so the Hezbollah in 1983 began exporting this tactic and this knowledge.
Hmm. What exactly is the tactic and the knowledge? I mean, it seems to be so sort of low-tech and simple, you know. So
it's more than just the obvious of, you take some dynamite and you strap it to you. It requires, as you've mentioned, you know, this gentleman who's done reconnaissance in Israel,
right.
It requires a certain amount of reconnaissance. You need to have quartermasters who can procure the weapon. You need to have a monitor who will secure the bomber and make sure that they don't change their mind. There's generally a film crew that will take a last will and testament, as well as in the videotape, brand the bomber. In other words, each of these videotapes very often have a big logo of the organization right behind, so that you don't have more than one organization trying to take credit, as we see from yesterday's attack in Egypt at Sharm el-Sheikh. You have at least two different Islamic groups who have tried to take credit for this attack, and so that's one of the reasons why the groups make these videotapes. Both it forces the bomber not to change their mind because they're now committed. They're essentially dead man walking. But also because it allows the organization to take proper credit where credit is due.
Well, in terms of Amir Bloom, again, the author of Dying to Kill, The Allure of Suicide Terror, in terms of it actually, and when I mentioned earlier about asymmetrical warfare, it seems that in Iraq, It's not sending out a few people at a time as Al Qaeda does, and obviously they spend a lot of time trying to find people who they can get in, and who will carry out the deed. It seems that it's actually almost a military campaign in Iraq, and you had an opinion piece recently in the Los Angeles Times talking about the Saudi Arabian connection to the rash of suicides in Iraq. It seems to me, and it's interesting, by the way, that the Saudi ambassador has been replaced in London, often referred to as Bandar Bush because of his close connection to the Bush family. He's been replaced by Prince Turki, former head of Saudi intelligence, who was to some extent even a mentor of bin Laden's, but he certainly was close friends of bin Laden's until they had a parting of the way. And he has also apparently been quite uncooperative in the early about the Khobar bombings, etc. So I have a feeling that what's going on in Iraq vis-a-vis the Saudis is that this strategic blunder of going into Iraq has resulted in us handing over the eastern half of Iraq, where all the oil is, to the Iranians through this new government that's essentially an Iranian surrogate government. And the Sunni insurgency, even though there's obviously a Ba'athist dimension to it, is being fueled by these suicide bombers that are coming in from Saudi Arabia. And to me, it indicates that perhaps it's a surrogate war that's going on there between Iran and Saudi Arabia. What do you think of that theory?
Well, I think that, you know, there's something to be said of the fact that there are these regional balances of power, and it's very much a zero-sum competition between what is perceived as Shiism and Sunniism. I mean, the Wahhabi, Salafi, global jihad perception of the world views the Shia as even more threatening than the Americans or, you know, the Crusaders and the Jews and all of the other enemies that bin Laden lists. So the fact that there's all these Saudis, who are the most militant jihadists, wrote about in last Sunday's paper, the monarchy is perfectly willing to allow them to leave because it essentially exports the problem away from, you know, their proximity to the United States, to the coalition, and to the Iraqi civilians.
So in other words, Mir, instead of attacking the House of Saud, they're attacking the Americans.
Precisely, because in part I wrote about the fact that there's been a split within the jihad movement in Saudi Arabia about how best to proceed. And there was a decision made as soon as the Saudis began finally cracking down on Osama bin Laden's friends and the affiliated al-Qaeda networks only after Saudi Arabia became targeted in 2003. But for the first 2 years of the alleged war against terror where Saudi Arabia was an ally, they didn't do anything. In fact, they continued to fund the global jihad, and they even funded the martyrs in Palestine. So that said, I would say that definitely there's an interest on the part of the monarchy to allow them to leave, but at the same time, if this ends up being a thorn in the side of, you know, an expanding Shiism, that's not a problem. But two things, though. It's interesting, we are also seeing that Iran, the Iranian Shias, and the Ayatollahs in Iran are not necessarily seeing people like Muqtada al-Sadr as puppets. So it's interesting, there are also divisions that are emerging within the Shiism bloc, looking at the fact that the Iraqi Shias are perfectly willing to go by a Western interpretation of democracy versus a Vilayet-e Faqih is what they have in Iran. And so it's not clear to me that these two groups are working closely together. In fact, among some of the Iranian circles, there's discussion about a competition. So you've got, I don't want to say it's fascinating, but it's a very complicated mosaic of different groups with different interests. These Zarqawi-affiliated terrorists that are largely doing the suicide bombings have less than 10% Iraqi nationals. So that's why I would go beyond to say it's not just the war in Iraq. If it was just a question of occupation and that this is a tool that one uses against occupation, we should see at least as many Iraqis. But it's the opposite. There are increasing number of Iraqis, including the Wolf Brigades and other militia units attached to the military, that now are seeking to kill Zarqawi. In other words, they don't want Zarqawi there either. And we're seeing, finally, an emergence within the ulama theological discussions and chat rooms on the web, that they are beginning to think twice about this tactic. Even Zarqawi's own mentor, Muqdesi, has come out against the use of suicide bombings against the Iraqi civilians and has actually chastised publicly his former student, Zarqawi. And there was a number of other radical sheikhs previously who extolled the use of suicide bombing always against the Israelis, who are now coming out against the use of this tactic against the Londoners.
What Mia Bloom, though, I mean, the reason that the Shia are essentially on board and this new army that the Pentagon keeps touting all the time is almost entirely Shia and Kurd. I guess the logic of it is that the reason that the Shia aren't, except for Muqtada al-Sadr, he had his little moment there where he took on the coalition, but I think he was doing that for internal political reasons. Mm-hmm. But by and large, they are basically keeping their powder dry, because why should they not? The Iranians are telling them to cooperate with the Americans, and they're doing that simply because we're fighting their enemy, the Sunni, and it seems that at the best, what we have is the contours of a civil war already exposed, or at the worst, you're going to have a kind of roiling mess on the western half that essentially could spill into Jordan, and you know the Israelis will probably end up with you know this whole mess as their West Bank.
Well, absolutely, and I think that when you look at some of Bin Laden Zarqawi's earlier statements, there was an intention on the part of the larger al-Qaeda network. I think the old al-Qaeda no longer exists and is a much more looser affiliation of different groups and affiliated groups and sub-networks. But one of the intentions right from the get-go was to wreak sectarian chaos in order to create, at least in the future, a civil war between the Sunnis and the Shiis, and at a larger level between, you know, the House of Islam and the House of War. So the idea that the militias are being organized around the different sectarian groups, either the Peshmerga and the Kurds on the one hand, or the Wolf Brigade and some of these other radical groups from the Shia sector, I think in the short run, it may alleviate the onus of responsibility for the United States, but in the long term, it has the possibility of fracturing the way Lebanon fractured in 1975. So that it's a short-term panacea, but ultimately it could complicate matters in the long term.
Well, finally, Mia Bloom, is there any way for the West to play catch up here? Because clearly, if you go back to the bombing of the Marine barracks during the Reagan administration in the early 80s, it's the same incredibly efficient, one guy kills 200 plus Marines. Obviously, a lot of planning goes into these things, and there's obviously a political mind behind it. It did, after all, get the United States to withdraw from Lebanon, and there's clearly a political mind behind the Madrid bombing and the London bombings in terms of putting pressure on trying to peel off the coalition in Iraq. Is there any there doesn't seem to be any equivalent planning on our side. We just seem to be sort of sitting there like a big, you know, duck in the crosshairs. So
I think there's some lost opportunities. For instance, there was a bombing in Iraq about 2 weeks ago in which more than 25 children were killed. And it, you know, regardless of the ethnicity or the religious identity of the victim, children are pretty much sacrosanct in Islam and are never really permitted to be targets. They're never going to be acceptable. And that really should have been exploited. I think we also missed an opportunity with the Beslan attack, perpetrated again by the Chechen Al-Qaeda-related rebels in September of 2004. So I think that, you know, we need to have increasing numbers of Muslim clerics coming forward saying that this is ultimately an un-Islamic ideology. This is not what the Quran says. This is not what Muhammad ever said in the Sunnah, in the Hadith. And to show the fact that there are serious hypocrisies, these radical pulpit clerics are actually not sources of Islamic ideology and jurisprudence. They, you know, they have to then, that's why they get these fatwas either from radical clerics in Saudi Arabia or Egypt. They themselves cannot write fatwas. And I think it would be important for more Islamic clerics to come forward and say, no, this is not what the Quran says. This is, you know, the second part of the surah that they're quoting actually says, however, Muhammad preferred to make peace and negotiated with the enemy and never attacked poor, weak, lame, elderly or young victims. I mean, so that that's one thing, that we're not really sufficiently exploiting these divisions that are emerging within Islamic theology. But we also have to make some very tough foreign policy choices and understand that there are going to be ramifications to the choices we make, whether it's the war in Iraq and how we go about that, or whether it's the fact that we don't sufficiently pressure Saudi Arabia to prevent this grim export that I talked about last week.
Well, I thank you for joining us, Mia Bloom, and I guess the bottom line is that the only person who dissuade an Islamist who's about to become a radical is a moderate Islamist. No blonde, blue-eyed Christian or Jew can do that. So
precisely. It has to come from within their own community, because otherwise it has no legitimacy.
I thank you again for joining us.
Well, Ian, thank you so much for having me.
Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with Mia Bloom, who's an assistant professor of political science at the University of Cincinnati and a consultant to the New Jersey Office of Counterterrorism. She's the author of a new book, Dying to Kill, The Allure of Suicide Terror. I'm now speaking with Bruce Shapiro, who's an investigative reporter and political analyst who has written extensively on civil rights, human rights, the death penalty, and the Supreme Court for Salon.com, New York Times, Harper's, The Guardian of London, and The Nation, among other publications. He's the author of a recent book, Shaking the Foundations, 200 Years of Investigative Journalism in America. And in terms of investigative journalism, I guess there's two stories out which I'd like to talk to you about, Bruce Shapiro. One, of course, is the they're related to the extent that the nomination of Roberts to the Supreme Court did take the other one off the headlines for a while, and that, of course, is the story of the worm that's slowly turning in terms of the special prosecutor in the matter of the outing of the wife of the diplomat who contradicted the president's claims in the State of the Union that Saddam was trying to buy uranium from Niger. Let's begin with the Roberts nomination. What do you think is the, I mean, it seems to me that you can't really, I think it's a waste of time going after this man in terms of the clients he had, in terms of all these corporate clients that he had, because lawyers have clients all the time. Criminal lawyers have some very distasteful clients, but they do the best they can. So I don't know that that's a particularly fertile arena to try and find some vulnerabilities. What about the fact that this man's wife is obviously an anti-abortion activist? I believe she's the founder of a group called Feminists for Life.
Well, she's not a founder. Jean Fallon Roberts is the former executive vice president of Feminists for Life. But look, I think, Ian, that you've covered a lot of ground here, and let's go back. I mean, the question really at bottom is there a way, is it worthwhile for progressives, for Democrats in the Senate, for activists to oppose the Roberts nomination? Are there reasonable grounds to oppose the Roberts nomination? Or is this a fight we should just give up? And I think the fact that someone like yourself is saying, well, he's just a lawyer, he's just defending clients, suggests to me how sophisticated and successful this choice by the White House has been. But let's back up a few steps. First of all, let's not forget that there have been several important nominations to the Supreme Court, which in their early days looked just as unassailable, indeed more unassailable, than Judge Roberts does now. You can go back to 1968 when President Johnson appointed Abraham Fortas to be Chief Justice to replace then Chief Justice Earl Warren. It turned out that upon examination, there were some conflicts of interest in Fortas's past, and he had to step down. You can go to Judge Robert Bork, nominated by President Reagan in 1986, a very distinguished scholar who turned out to be, when you put him on the stand in his confirmation hearings, a kind of extreme and idiosyncratic person who defeated himself, in a sense. But at this early point, you couldn't tell. And even with Clarence Thomas, who now sits on the Supreme Court, there was not an inkling within the first couple of weeks after his nomination of how profound the opposition would be to him, and indeed of the allegations of sexual harassment, which very nearly defeated him. So there is a long way to go between now and the middle or end of September, when Judge Roberts will face the Senate Judiciary Committee and the Senate for a confirmation vote. Now, what is the terrain on which he might be opposed? Well, the question of his corporate clients, or the question of his work for the Bush and Reagan administration, has come up because, for instance, in the Bush administration in 1990, in the course of writing a brief against federal funds for family planning groups that provided information about abortion, a very narrow, specific subject, Judge Roberts, then Deputy Solicitor General Roberts, went out of his way to put a little footnote in which said, by the way, Roe versus Wade should be overturned. It was wrongly argued and should be overturned. Later on in his confirmation hearings to be a judge, Judge Roberts said, well, I was just doing what a lawyer does, reflecting the wishes of my client. Baloney. This is a man, it's not a question of any individual case. This is a man whose choice of clients, whose choices as an attorney, from the very first day he arrived in Washington straight out of Harvard Law School, have been in service not only to the Republican Party, but to the most conservative policies and elements within it. And I think that needs to be said. He's not the kind of lawyer who takes all sides as a matter of principle. If you go down his resume, you will not find, quite remarkably, in fact, a single major pro bono case in which he represented the poor, in which he represented the public interest against corporate interests. This is a guy who, as a political lawyer, has made a career of defending the most conservative policies put forward by the Republican leadership in the Reagan and Bush one years, and as a corporate attorney has made a practice of defending or advancing the interests of some of our most grievous assaults on the environment, desire to deregulate industry, and so on. Those are his choices. That's his orientation. And I think that in and of itself is really worth questioning. However, I also think that that's not necessarily even the most important thing. Now, you can cherry pick his 60 or so decisions, or you can go through the briefs that he's filed, but there are two big issues that I think have not really yet been scratched and that we're going to see emerge in the next few weeks. One of them is historical. When Judge Roberts was nominated to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia, the Senate Judiciary Committee asked the White House for copies of all of the Justice Department's internal memoranda that Roberts had signed when he was Deputy Solicitor General in the Bush administration and Deputy White House Counsel in the Reagan administration. All of his memos on a variety of subjects. A huge number of these the administration refused to hand over. There's a long paper trail. That's a secret, frankly, and may reflect Judge Roberts' thinking on the key social issues which the Reagan and first Bush administrations chose to take on in court, from abortion to desegregation of schools, or slowing down desegregation of schools, to corporate regulation, to civil liberties. There's a wide range of issues that we don't actually know Judge Roberts' thinking on, and which I know that Democrats and some Republicans on the Judiciary Committee are very anxious to take a look at. That is one huge compost pile of controversy that may prove quite fertile.
Well, Bruce Shapiro, though, I believe that this nomination and this battle, whether it's obviously it's already been joined, because the Swift Boat people are putting out their commercials for Roberts at the moment. But the long and the short of it is, this is all about abortion. There was a recent book by Thomas Frank, What's the Matter with Kansas, that tried to analyze why people vote against their class interests in this country and vote Republican, farmers and working class people. And it suggested that the corporatists who control the Republican Party were using their Christian soldiers as to keep them sort of activated by continually having this kind of irritant of abortion in their face, but they never planned to actually overturn Roe v. Wade. They needed it as a kind of burr under the saddle, if you will. I think that's a totally wrong analysis. I don't think these people have been on this crusade for the last 30 years to lose. And it seems to me that this guy, if they don't pin him down, the first opportunity he'll get, and there are a couple of cases working their way through the docket, he will do what he can to... They won't overturn Roe v. Wade frontally, but they'll kick it back to the states under some kind of states' rights rubrics, and then we'll have this apartheid in America where you'll have the red states banning abortions, and the next day's in the legislature, I guarantee you, there'll be 10 guys with bills banning abortions. And so you'll have this bizarre split in the country where, half of it will be modern and half of it will be medieval.
Well, let's not forget that... In many ways, we already have that split. The red states, if you will, many states have succeeded through the cost of insurance, through government restrictions, through a variety of means, in sharply limiting the availability of abortion, especially in rural areas. There are big parts of the country, large tracts of the country, in which an abortion is, in a practical sense, very difficult to get. Medical schools are no longer training physicians to perform abortions in a routine way, even in a lot of places. This is so the divide you mentioned already exists. But back to Judge Roberts. I think it's a mistake to think that the right in this country is just one thing. And I think there's a two-word answer to the argument that you gave, and the two-word answer that relates very directly to the Roberts nomination and what I think it's about, are Terri Schiavo. Now, Terri Schiavo, on the one hand, was a case which was very useful to Governor Jeb Bush in Florida, to President Bush, to the Christian right, because in the absence of abortion, in the absence of a Supreme Court nominee, this was a good surrogate issue that roused the emotions of the troops. But something interesting happened along the way, which is that the vast majority of Americans, 70% if you looked at every poll, were deeply dismayed, alarmed by the intrusion into family privacy that the Christian right was proposing in the Terri Schiavo case, never came around. And indeed, I think that there are a lot of people looking at the future of the Republican Party, and in particular the corporate interests that you mentioned, but also individual Republican leaders, people like McCain, and others who have their eye on the White House a few years from now, who see real danger to the Republican project if the religious right goes too far. And if, for instance, abortion were to be overturned by the Supreme Court, I think that prospect actually alarms Republican strategists, because they know that as much as they need the religious rights church buses to win, and they do, they also need the votes of moderate pro-choice women, pro-choice Americans who, for one reason, have different reasons for voting Republican, and who, if they feel a genuine sense of threat on through government intrusion, through an assault on reproductive choice, may well turn away in dismay from Republicans. And I think that prospect is very much on the minds of a lot of Republican strategists right now. Now, Judge Roberts is an interesting case here. I mean, the White House, with this nomination, is actually trying, in a rather deft way thus far, to please two constituencies at once. On the one hand, they're presenting a nominee who signed fiercely anti-abortion language when he was Deputy Solicitor General, who called for Roe v. Wade being overturned, and that feeds red meat to the religious right, whose wife, as you said, is very active in Feminists for Life, an interesting group which is against abortion, though also in favor of child care and stuff like this. And then, on the other hand, so you throw red meat to the anti-abortion people with his past, and then on the other hand, and it's his family associations, and then on the other hand, you try to convince everybody else, as Judge Roberts did in his first confirmation here for the court, that, well, this is just my work as a lawyer, I don't really necessarily believe this one way or another, and you try to convince the rest of the country that he's fairly moderate. Now, it can't be both. Judge Roberts either is a red meat social conservative on abortion, or he's going to be a moderate on matters of choice, and we don't know. And that's one reason why this matter of the memos and the papers that he signed inside government, which are not huge state secrets, in which the national security would be threatened. That's one reason why it's very important that that language come to light for those kinds of clues to his thinking. I think that actually abortion politics, while important to the nomination, to the choice of Judge Roberts, because he is able to present both faces to both constituencies, is not the core issue here. I don't think it's all about abortion. I actually think that the Bush administration selected Judge Roberts for a different reason, and that reason is that if you go through his rulings, if you go through most recently his vote on one of the Guantanamo cases, you go through his rulings as an appellate judge on matters of policing, you go through his briefs, the one consistent thread is that you find him very sympathetic to the concerns of the executive branch. This is a guy whose service in government was in defense of the White House all along. This is a guy whose rulings favor strong policing, favor the ability of the president to go around Congress and around international law on Guantanamo and on detainees there. This is a guy who will be a friend to the administration on in the huge number of war on terror-related cases that are filtering up through the courts now. And that, I believe, is the primary motivation for his nomination.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, Bruce Shapiro, let's just turn to the other subject. In fact, you can bridge the two subjects of the Wilson Plame Rove Libby special prosecutor story and what we're talking about here, in the sense that Frank Rich has a piece in the New York Times today saying that it was, after all, the Attorney General, then the White House Counsel Gonzalez, who after the CIA referred the criminal matter of Valerie Plame's outing, Gonzalez took 12 hours to inform the White House staff that it must preserve all relevant materials. And there's some indication that he may be vulnerable, since he might, you know that these guys have just strung this thing out forever, and it's totally disingenuous of the president to say that he was trying to get to the bottom of the matter. They've clearly been stalling all along. So do you see perhaps this may derail in the idea that Gonzalez could replace Rehnquist when he eventually steps down?
I suspect not, and I think that Gonzalez, in all of the matters that have his fingerprints on them in the Justice Department and in the White House Counsel's Office, has been extraordinarily careful to not give the impression of covering things up, but instead to be following the letter of the law. I actually have some deep concerns about the plain matter. I mean, I'm as happy as anybody to see Karl Rove and now Scooter Libby in trouble. And if they get indicted for perjury, that will put a song in my heart. But I also, frankly, worry that the consequence of us on the left, us who don't like the war, us who don't like the Bush administration, becoming obsessed with the pursuing, with tracking down a leak in Washington, the consequence of this is much more likely to be to intimidate sources who might be talking to reporters who, you know, news organizations are now releasing information, might be to put reporters in jail, as has already happened. If we need one thing to derail this administration, it's not getting rid of Karl Rove. It's sources in Washington who are unafraid of leaking classified information about the war on terror to the press, and reporters who are unafraid of printing it. And I fear that so far, the main political effect of the Plame obsession and the Plame investigation has been to intimidate sources and jail and, in some cases, intimidate reporters, make it harder for reporters to do their job at a crucial time.
Yeah, but Joe Wilson feels that the reason they added his wife rather than punishing him was to send a signal to the people inside the intelligence community who knew that the evidence that the White House was putting forward on WMD and the pretext for war was bogus. So,
I agree with that. I think Ambassador Wilson is right that they were trying both to punish him, discredit him, and intimidate other whistleblowers within the administration. Sure, but that doesn't translate into a particularly enthusiastic embrace of the special prosecutor who's investigating this.
Well, you have to admit that, Bruce, that it's pretty extraordinary that the one special prosecutor, they've so far this administration, you know, Clinton had about 15 of them hounding him and all of his cabinet members. The one guy that they get is now apparently zeroing in on the two second most powerful people in the country, the chief aide to the president and the chief aide to the vice president.
And as I said, I'm as delighted as anyone. This is extraordinary and wonderful. But what is the situation we're faced with here? We are faced with a massive war in which war crimes are being committed, Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo. We're faced with an administration which is using terrorism as an excuse to clamp down on civil liberties at home. All these things which your listeners know well. In each case, what we really need is is leakers who are unafraid of leaking and reporters who are unafraid of telling the truth. And I worry that the primary effect of this case has been to intimidate leakers and intimidate reporters. And that's right. That's not a good thing. That doesn't mean we don't enjoy Rove being in trouble, but it doesn't mean that we should really think about what's in the best interest.
Thanks for joining us, Bruce. And we'll just wait to see whether we have to worry. I thank you for joining us.
Bye-bye.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. Just speaking there with Bruce Shapiro, who's an investigative reporter and political analyst, and he's the author of a recent book, Shaking the Foundations, 200 Years of Investigative Journalism in America. I'm now speaking with Jim Marcinkowski, who is a former CIA case officer, and he was also a classmate of Valerie Plame's at the farm, the CIA's clandestine training place out near Williamsburg in Virginia. And Jim, as a classmate of Valerie, and I know your colleague Larry Johnson's also was a classmate of hers, you were all on a panel this Friday in the House, a Democratic panel chaired by Congressman Waxman, talking about the serious nature of the outing of a clandestine officer. Can you just put it quickly, succinctly on the record? Obviously, this was originally, the special prosecutor was put into business by a criminal referral from the CIA to the Justice Department. And we just mentioned that that then White House Counsel Gonzalez sat on it for a while. But the long and short of it is they thought it was a serious enough matter. And we know that the Republican talking points have tried to spin it into something else, that it's just, you know, a political spat between the Democrats and the Republicans, and the guy's wife was sending him on a boondoggle and all of this kind of stuff. But let's just deal with the seriousness of the matter. It seems to me that if the United States government invests in people like you and Valerie and puts you through these elaborate training and puts you under deep cover, that's an investment, I take it they take it seriously.
That's exactly correct. Number one, it does take a lot of money to train these people, and it also takes a lot of experience acquired in the agency to really be effective as a case officer. And yes, there was a special joint oversight hearing on the national security consequences of disclosing the identity of a covert intelligence officer. That did occur on Friday. Just Democrats were in attendance. And basically what we talked about and discussed at that hearing was the breach of trust that this issue comes down to. And it was a huge breach of trust by the White House in the confidences used and required by the intelligence community to effectively carry out its mandate to protect the American people. And that really strikes at the heart of this matter. And you're also correct in that there's a lot of people out there that are trying to deflect responsibility by calling Valerie Plame's secretary a paper pusher. She wasn't undercover. And Ian, I think we have to take a real big leap here, okay? Mm-hmm. And there's two things to respond to those kinds of critics. It's two things. Number one, I think we all have to acknowledge that the CIA itself is in the best position to know what her status was and is. That's number one. Number two, we have to have at least some faith in CIA legal counsel, because that they're competent enough to make that initial kind of a prima facie case that she fit under the law that would prohibit her disclosure. So if we arrive at the conclusion the CIA is in the best position and their legal counsel is at least minimally competent, they're the ones that made the referral to the Justice Department. And if you think the CIA is lying, then I think we're wasting everybody's time. So that's the quick response to the critics out there that try to belittle the status of Valerie Plame and try to belittle the whole situation.
And she was what they call a NOC, which is non-official cover. And I understand that is actually the most vulnerable of all of undercover covert operatives, because if you're operating under diplomatic cover, and particularly in the old days of the Cold War, if you were busted, you flashed your diplomatic passport and you got a free pass out of jail. But if you are a NOC, you could just disappear in Lubyanka and nobody would know.
Well, and that's exactly correct. Even I don't know what her status was. I have read accounts that she, in fact, was not. And if she was, that's exactly correct. They're out there collecting intelligence on behalf of the United States in foreign countries, and if they are caught, they're going to be treated like they're going to be subjected to the laws of the country in which they are caught. That is the bottom line, which means in many cases it'll be espionage or treason on a part of her and her contacts, and the result is some kind of a life imprisonment or a death penalty.
And the commercial front, I'm not sure of the details of how much Brewster Jennings was a CIA creation or whether they sort of piggybacked into it, but essentially her outing did blow that proprietary, and also apparently had an extremely damaging effect on the general network, because she was working as an energy consultant and doing a lot of stuff in the former Soviet Union, where all of the fissile material, where most of the fissile material is, and it's not entirely secured, And as you well know, Jim, that it's, the people know how to make bombs, unfortunately. It's just a fact. But they don't know how to get hold of this stuff, the fuel for the bombs. And if they did, they'd be letting them off. We'd have nuclear car bombs going off everywhere. So,
well, that's exactly correct. I think you're right when you talk about the damage as far as exposing Brewster Jennings. You know, no one knows at this point whether she was the only one that was using that cover. So the fact that you know, that came out in the media and was given to the media, that's another a sign that people really don't care. Each agent may not have their own cover company. Maybe that was a Brewster Jennings, could have been used by 5, 6, 7, 8, maybe a dozen CIA case officers as a cover for the travels overseas. And in that case, we have damaged not only Valerie Plame and all her contacts overseas, but we may have damaged other CIA case officers and their contacts overseas because they used that cover. Now they know, the whole world knows, that it was a front company for the CIA.
Well, but the real work of a covert operative is to recruit assets, you know, and essentially what your job is to break the laws in foreign lands and to encourage citizens of foreign lands to break the laws and take risks, and obviously they get compensated. But the long and the short of it is, presumably there were a bunch of people in the former Soviet Union's frayed nuclear infrastructure, you know, and obviously power plants and bomb factories. There's a relationship there. So it's not inconceivable that a lot of people that the United States has been recruiting to find out whether there's any leakage of nuclear material. Obviously, you've got to go to the source, right? Seriously, I mean, we don't know this, but there's been some speculation that more than the cover of Brewster Jennings was blown.
Well, that's exactly correct. You're showing to different techniques used by the agency to again collect information, when you do in fact go out there and recruit agents and those kinds of things, the first thing you have to do, number one, to get people to believe that you're helping them as well as us, and to carry out whatever task that you ask them to perform. Many times people are willing to do that, but the first question that always comes back as the number one priority is, can you ensure my safety and that of my family in most cases? Because if I get caught, I'm going to get killed. So that's why the breach of cover is such a breach of trust, because now as the CIA is operating overseas, they have to. The case officers on the street today all over the world are going to get confronted by their assets and are saying, listen, you know, this person got exposed. You know, if they're going to expose...
Well, exposed by the White House, though. That's the part of it.
Exactly right. If your government's going to expose the home team, meaning your own case officers, and they're going to do it from the White House, what assurances can you give me that I'm going to not be some cannon fodder out here and you're not going to care about me, and maybe somebody else in your government will expose me, you see? So what has been damaged here is the credibility of our case officers to go over there and assure our clients or our agents all over the world that their security is our number one concern. And that's where the damage is, and that's where it is continuing to be damaged based on the inaction of the White House to take any step to send a different message around the world.
Let me again remind the audience, if I may. I'm speaking with Jim Marcinkowski, who is a former CIA case officer. He was a classmate of Valerie Plame's, the officer who was outed in retaliation for an op-ed piece that her husband, Ambassador Joe Wilson, wrote. And they both went through covert training at the CIA farm and were talking about the importance of covers, the extent to which a lot of time, effort, and money goes into creating these legends for America's spies, and the cavalier nature with which it was outed. She was outed for obviously for political reasons is should be disturbing to all, particularly in the light of what Jim just told us. But again, Jim, you know, I just was down here in Santa Monica, which often jokingly referred to as the People's Republic of Santa Monica, and there was having a picnic on the beach, and there was a fellow who obviously was more conservative than the usual Santa Monicans, and he was just reading off the Republican National Committee's talking points. I mean, they are really having an effect in terms of trying to make this thing seem like it's just a political spat when, in fact, it goes to the heart of what government professionals are all about in the national security field, in defense, intelligence, and foreign policy. It's supposed to be a bipartisan, nonpartisan activity, and they are trying to make it, trivialize it and marginalize it as just a partisan thing. And I mean, they're having an effect. It's just breathtaking. But
I believe you're absolutely correct. They are having an effect. They are having an effect on the people of the United States who listen to, you know, everyone's kind of tuned into their own channels nowadays, and depending on what great bad along the political spectrum, you just get that information. But I'll tell you this. They may win. They're, number one, by giving it over to the Republican National Committee and having the Republican Party chairman speak about it.
Who's a protege of Karl Rove's, you know.
Exactly. They're sending a message here. Number one, they only care about the partisans in the United States, and they're being effective, maybe, at convincing people this was no big deal. But I'll tell you who they're not being effective with, and that's the people around the world who absolutely know better. People look at this thing and go, wait a minute. Now, not only did it occur, now they have the political party involved defending it instead of someone from the Bush White House directly or some government official. That all sends the wrong message out there. One that is political and politics is gonna trump national security. And two, the longer they do it, the more damage they're doing, because people around the world are listening to this saying, you know what, these people really don't care. This is all politics. I'm not risking my life for you guys. Forget it.
Well, it's an amazing story, and it is, as I was saying to the earlier guest, it's pretty ironic that we had about 15 special prosecutors hounding the Clinton administration. Only one has been inflicted upon the Bush administration, and they obviously had to do it because of the criminal referral from the CIA. At this point in the crosshairs, the second most powerful people in the country, and in the chief deputy of the president and the chief deputy of the vice president, if we are to believe the leaks in these press reports. So what's your hunch, just in closing, Jim, on what might happen here?
Well, I have a pretty good suspicion that, in fact, there will be indictments, whether it's for obstruction of justice or perjury, at a minimum. And my guess is you're going to see probably a half dozen people that are really, really involved. They're either going to be indicted or they're going to be unindicted co-conspirators, because this was a group effort. There's no question in my mind. One person didn't do this. It was a concerted effort by a number of different individuals, and I'm hoping that we'll see some indictments sometime really soon.
And the other side of the story, which I've been working on for some time, is, the whole thing began with Wilson being sent to Niger based upon documents which later proved to be forgeries. And I was told by a former senior CIA officer, the head of counterterrorism, that those documents were forged here in the United States. So it's possible that there's another shoe to drop that's actually a bigger shoe than the one stepping on Karl Rove.
Well, sometimes you peel away the onion slowly and you find out the whole inside is rotten. I think we're pretty well along that process right now.
I thank you for joining us in Los Angeles, Jim Marcinkowski.
Thanks for having me.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with Jim Marcinkowski, who is a former CIA case officer, and he was a classmate of Valerie Plame's at the CIA farm, and where undercover officers are trained. And he's talking about the serious nature of what the special prosecutor has been investigating in this case, which is, in spite of the president's claim that he wants to get to the bottom of it, they have clearly dragged this thing out forever. But now that there seems to be at least some indication that it may be heading towards the finishing line here after a marathon of obfuscation. I thank the producer, Lewis Vandenberg, the engineer, Marcus Maxwell, the assistant producers, Carol Coote and Elizabeth Venable. This program and all previous ones are available at ianmasters.org.